Improvised Thoughts, Music and Talk About Music, with your host, B.G. Adair.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is B.G. Adair with Improvised Thoughts, and tonight I have a rare treat. There's a rare connection. We have a new artist, or at least new to a lot of us, a wonderful new piano player on the scene who's actually been around a while, but his name is Bill Cunliffe, and we're going to say hello to him and listen to some of his new project. Hello, Bill.
Hi, BG. How are you?
Fine, thank you. It's very, very nice to have you on the show, and I got to tell you, this new record, A Rare Connection, is just a killer.
Oh, that's great.
It is so beautiful.
I'm glad you like it. Thank you very much.
Well, I think you're going to be hearing a lot of people say that, and you, we'll talk some more about this later, because your stated purpose was to bring this traditional music into the 90s, and by golly, you sure did it. It's just a beautiful straddling of the various kinds of jazz that all of us are familiar with, and it sounds so fresh and so new.
Well, that's
and
great.
So technically well done, but it still has that really wonderful mainstream swing feel to it. It's just a great album. Let's go right now to the opening tune, as a matter of fact, and let's listen to Stella by Starlight by Bill Cunliffe.
Thank you.
Stella by Starlight. The artist is Bill Cunliffe. The record project is A Rare Connection on the Discovery label. Let's talk about the personnel on this record. And
Last summer, which would be the summer of 93, mm-hmm. I had kind of celebrated about my 10th anniversary of sending out tapes to record companies and getting rejections. And I had recorded...
I know that.
several,
I know that very well.
Yes, I've recorded several kind of trio projects. Playing piano trio, I think, is the thing I enjoy the best because of the interaction between the musicians, you know, mm-hmm. that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, Discovery gave me a call. I had done a couple of studio projects for them. And they said, oh, we would love to sign you as an artist. We love you. We think you're great. And what we want you to do is do Paul Simon's music and Jimmy Webb's music and Joni Mitchell's music and do all these albums, these concept albums, of songs that have already been recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, thank you. You know, that's really nice. But, I at that point, I had given up the ghost and had basically sold my house in Cincinnati when I moved out to L.A. and spent every last cent I had on an original tape.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually the tape that you're hearing now.
Really?
And after we did the Paul Simon record for Discovery, they liked it so much that they were willing to release this. So that's how, you know, this got out. But the personnel on it, rather than doing a strictly piano trio jazz record like pretty much, you know,
mm-hmm.
even your Federal Express guy who shows up has a piano trio album. It seems like so many people have done it.
Mm-hmm.
That I wanted to do something a little different. I wanted to do different things that would showcase the piano in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of my friends are really intelligent people that are non-musicians. And I was trying to think about them a little bit when I was doing this. And it was how to make do what I like to do most, but then dress it up in the most beautiful outfit I could.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why there's some piano solo on there. That's why there's some trio stuff. That's why there's some quartet and some quintet stuff on there. And Bob Shepard, who is one of my best friends out here, is a saxophone player with Steely Dan. And he agreed to help me produce it. And we were just discussing drummers. And he said, well, who would be your favorite drummer if you had all the money in the world? I said, Peter Erskine. And so he picked up the phone and he called Peter Erskine.
Wow.
And we got Peter to do it. So it really was a wonderful thing to have him do it because he's just musically, he can do anything, and everything he does is just perfect. I just really love him.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Carpenter is a bass player that I used to work with in Cincinnati. I've known Dave for 14 years, so that was the core band.
The whole album sounds like you guys have been together for a real long time.
Well, it was done in 6 hours.
That surprised me when I read in your press release that the whole thing was done pretty much in one day.
Well, I kind of cheated. We did go back a second day and add synthesizer on two tunes and then mm-hmm. Percussion on two tunes.
Well, still, but by today's standards, that's a very short time for an album to take place.
Well, it is, and you know, I kind of like it. I mean,
yeah.
About half the things were first takes.
That the feel is always there on those first takes that you sometimes lose in a studio setting.
You're absolutely right. You know, sometimes you get the right notes,
right.
But usually the first or second take is the best. So
mm-hmm.
what I usually do is, I'll usually if we have it by the second take, something that sounds real good, I'll just keep it. And if there's anything that's really really screwed up,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'll fix it.
Yeah, that's the nice thing about the technology that we have available to us is that it gives you more choice.
That's right.
So let's go to the title tune. I really was knocked out with this. And why don't you set this up for us?
Sure. Actually, I was in North Carolina playing in a club, and this woman came up and introduced herself to me. And we went out to eat or something. We just talked and talked and talked into the night. And then we just kind of said goodnight, and I said, well, you know, I hope I see you again someday. And I basically never saw her again after that. It was just a really great kind of a one-time experience, but kind of bittersweet, you know,
yeah.
because it was just kind of a beginning and an ending all at once. Then I came home, and I turned on a tape recorder and just started playing, and this came out exactly like a perfect song. I mean, it just came out really well. So I just took what I did on the tape and copied it out into music, and that's what we recorded.
a rare connection. This is B.G. Adair with Improvised Thoughts, and I'm speaking to Bill Cunliffe, who has a new record project out. We've just heard the title track, A Rare Connection. Bill, you were born in Boston, and the press release that I have says, your mother played piano and your father was an absolute fanatic of the Boston Pops, and we listened to it on the radio every Sunday. So you grew up with a lot of opportunity to hear music of all kinds, didn't you?
I sure did, yeah. And I think most of it was kind of classics and then early kind of swing-oriented jazz, like Benny Goodman and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were you drawn to jazz then, or did that take some time?
Not really, no. You know, I really didn't hear much jazz as a kid. I mean, my dad, like I said, you know, the Glenn Miller and the Benny Goodman stuff was okay, but that was my dad's music, and I wasn't really into it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 9, you know, I started listening to the radio like everybody else, and listening to pop music and rock and stuff like that. I really didn't hear jazz until pretty late in life. I think I was about 20.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing in a club where I was doing some pop tunes and some kind of contemporary, I guess, jazz rock things, you know, like Stevie Wonder and Chuck Mangione and stuff like that, which was music I liked.
Right.
But a friend of mine was like, you know, you're a pretty good piano player. Did you ever hear of Oscar Peterson? And I said, no. And he gave me this record. And it was Sam Jones, Bobby Durham, and Oscar Peterson Trio.
Mm.
And it changed my life. I just sat for hours and hours with these two stereo speakers crammed around my ears just listening to this stuff. And it just changed my life. At that point, I knew that this was something I had to do.
I think Oscar must have changed the lives of a lot of piano players. He certainly did mine, too. The first time you hear Oscar Peterson is really kind of a monumental thing if you're a piano player, because just the sheer technical facility that he has just takes you to another level entirely of using that instrument.
Yeah, I would say so, but in light of what people say, to me, what really struck me was how good it felt, the groove.
Yeah, the groove
the feeling
is,
of it.
Oh yeah.
I think that actually blew me away far more than the notes, because I knew that I couldn't maybe get the notes, but I knew that maybe if I listened to it a lot, I could kind of cop some of that feel.
Mm-hmm.
And when I play with a trio, I want it to feel at least something like that. That's a real goal for me.
Yeah, it every record Oscar's ever made, and all his live performances too, as well, have that feel of, you just know he's having a good time. You just know that he's feeling good, and there's a big grin on his face.
Yeah, boy, it seems that way.
Yeah, it that really comes through, that music. Well, your record has a grin on its face, too, I got to tell you. This is just a lovely album.
Thank you.
Are talking to Bill Cunliffe. Bill, a lot of people down here probably know you from the Clayton Brothers Band and maybe some of the other things that you did. Let's back up here a little bit. And when you left Boston, you went to Duke as a psychology major, and I'm working up to all of your things that you did with the Buddy Rich Orchestra and stuff. But let's back up a little bit and tell the audience how you got there, how you got where you are now. So you went to college at Duke, and then you met Mary Lou Williams. What was that?
Right.
About?
She was a visiting artist on the faculty my senior year. And, you know, this was after I had heard Oscar. I was kind of struggling with trying to figure out maybe, gosh, this jazz thing is kind of cool. And when Mary Lou showed up, I walked into her office and I said, you know, I'd like to study with you.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a very hip lady. She was very, you know, friendly and open. And she knew that I had talent, even though I really didn't know anything about jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And she finally said, you know, you got to stop reading those books and start practicing and start listening to some Fats Waller and stuff. And I was like, well, never had anybody tell me that before. But she told me about Bud Powell and Errol Garner and Art Tatum and Thelonious Monk and Herbie Nichols, and really, mm-hmm. really started getting me going on the right path in terms of serious bebop jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, I went to Eastman School of Music, and actually, I was just kind of thinking about some kind of career in music. I didn't really know what.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into a great, great piano player and teacher there named Bill Dobbins.
Oh, yeah.
He's a brilliant musician. He just kind of took, you know, what I was doing and really kicked me in the pants to kind of get better, and he introduced me to some other piano players.
Mm-hmm.
Really learned how to play there. I mean, that was, I think, the best 3 years of my life in terms of musical growth. Never really thought about playing piano for a living or anything like that, so when I graduated from Eastman, I just took a teaching job in Cincinnati, outside of Cincinnati, at Central State University in Zeni, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for 3 years, and, you know, it was fine. I was making a good living and playing piano 4 or 5 nights a week in Cincinnati. But something was missing for me.
Yeah.
I wanted to, you know, play with players that were really like some of the best. And Dave Carpenter, a bass player that I used to work with in Dayton, got on the Buddy Rich Band. And he was like the young star bass player. And he called me one day and said, you know, Buddy needs a piano player. And so the rest is kind of history, as they say. In 1984, I quit my teaching job, moved out of my apartment, put everything in storage, gave up all my jobs, and went out with Buddy for a year and a half.
Wow. Did you enjoy that? Was that fun?
There were times that it was fun. I mean, he's a severe taskmaster.
Yes, that's what I hear.
He was very demanding.
But
a lot of the time, what he was doing was just kicking you in the pants so you'd play better.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that he felt he was doing that all the time. And I think that tension that went on the bandstand all the time in certain ways made the band play better, in the sense that we were an accurate type band and we only took chances when we knew we could pull them off. I think that the level of the band varied surprisingly little because of Buddy's real adherence to a certain musical standard. You learned to swing because you had to. It was a certain, your eighth note groove was very, very strong when you left that band because you had to, otherwise you wouldn't stay.
Right.
But I think after leaving the band, I saw other options and my playing opened up in other ways. But I still had that hardcore kind of ability to put the eighth note in the right place.
Right. You did several arrangements for his last album, Live on King Street.
Yes. Actually, it's kind of funny how I left the band. I was, I had been on the band a year and a half, and I was kind of getting cabin fever. I mean, you know, we rode 300 days
That's
a year.
That's hard. That's very hard.
We had an unaltered Greyhound bus. Everyone had two little seats, just like a regular bus. You know, it wasn't one of these, you know, rock and roll road buses with seats taken out and stuff. It was nothing like that at all. It was like really hardcore bus travel. And I was getting kind of tired of it. And I had a girlfriend in Cincinnati, and, you know, I wanted to, I don't know. After a while being on the road, you kind of, you do what you do on the road very well, but you kind of think like musically the rest of your life is sapping away from you.
Right.
So Buddy asked me one day, he says, you know, the Tina Turner tune, that's a really great tune. I'd like to do an arrangement on that. And he was talking about Proud Mary.
Oh, yeah.
And this was in 1985. And I really didn't want to do the arrangement because I really didn't think it would be right for the band. And I couldn't tell, I didn't really have the heart to tell Buddy I didn't want to do the arrangement. So I quit the band instead.
That sounds like one of the anecdotes in Bill Crow's book.
Oh, he's funny. I love the stuff he's written in that book.
just disappear.
Yeah, I had to get out of there. I had to anyway. That was just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, the road is really hard. Unfortunately, all of us at one time or another have to do the road, and it surprises me, I guess, as I get older, to find that even under great circumstances, if you have limousines instead of buses, it's still the road. And
it still
feels weird to be away from home that long and not do some of the other things in your life you need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I really do like, my schedule now is that every 2-3 weeks I go away for 3-4 days to tour. And I think that works pretty well for me. I probably need to get out even more than that just to support, you know, the new album. But pretty much once a month, I'm booking everything and setting up everything myself, and it's a lot of work, and I really don't like doing it. I would rather be practicing.
Yeah.
But until, you know, we hit the big time here, no one else is going to do it. So, you know, just about every month or so, I try to get out for at least 3-4 days and play some city.
I've had many, many conversations recently with people who have new album projects out, and to a person, they all say what you have just said, that the business of being in the music business in terms of getting your album out, getting it distributed, talking to disc jockeys, actually playing clubs and things, is such a business that it takes you away from the actual music.
It really does.
A great deal of the time. How do you juggle all that?
Well, I think the way I juggle all of it is I don't go out enough. Because first of all, I'm real busy here in town doing different musical projects that I like to do. I have a group with Bob Shepard. I also play in a band called Porcupine, and we have two albums out. And, you know, I have all these other musical activities that I love, and I can't really give them all up. But I often think of guys like Pat Metheny as kind of role models, because I think at an early age he said, well, this is a certain thing I'm going to do, and I'm going to put all my energy into this. And I think he's really done a marvelous job of doing that. In fact, in 2 weeks I'm doing a big band album of all Pat Metheny music with
a
very fine arranger named Bob Curnow, who's arranged all this music.
Mm-hmm.
It's really introduced me to how great a guitar player Pat is, you know, taking aside all the tunes and the arrangements and the production. He's a brilliant, brilliant jazz musician.
Yes,
I think
he is.
He's a guy who plays the heck out of bebop, but he also has added another kind of layer of really cool emotion and intellect onto the music. So in my own small way, on a smaller scale, I want to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to think, well, what would Pat do in this situation? You know, would he take this little $80 casual where I have to take a grand piano, you know, a little synthesizer and get in my car and drive for an hour?
Yeah,
and probably Pat would say, nah, I think I'm going to listen to some Coltrane and transcribe some solos instead.
Yeah, it's very hard to walk that line because you do have bills to pay.
Yeah,
you know, it's very hard to be able to choose those things sometimes that are going to do you good in the long run when you're looking at, you know, the electricity bill is due or whatever.
But if you focus on paying the bills too much, you won't do anything musically that you want to do.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Well, let's listen to some music and then we'll come back. I want to hear some more about all the wonderful things that are happening to you in your career, and I want the audience to get to know you a little bit. Let's go to a piece of music called Minnesota. Why don't you set this up for us and tell us about it and about the personnel?
Well, one common thing that jazz musicians do is they take a standard tune and write a different song on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the song Back Home Again in Indiana and wrote a tune on those chord changes, but kind of took it a little bit outside. So I thought Minnesota was real outside, so I called it Minnesota. Also, I wrote it for a friend of mine named Bruce Paulson, who's a really great trombone player who's just finished a project that he's trying to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And he's from Minnesota, so I kind of wrote it for him. But I want to record it because people really like the tune that I spoke with. And Bob Shepard is such a great, great musician. He's not as well known as he should be. He had a record out on Windham Hill a year or two ago, and he also plays with Steely Dan. So, and he also plays with Lyle Mays, one of my favorite piano players and favorite musician.
Yeah, too.
So I asked Bob to kind of produce my record for me because I wanted to have another set of ears, you know. I would bring him music and go, well, is this good? Is this lame? You know. And it helped a lot. It really, it helped get the best stuff on the record. And Bob is a great bass clarinet player, and I think it was his idea. I think it was his idea to try bass clarinet on this.
I thought it was a wonderful idea. It's just so fresh sounding.
Yeah, I love it. It gives it a little bit of humor. And humor is the hardest. I mean, it's easy to write music that makes you happy, and it's easy to write music that makes you sad or mournful, but it's really hard to do music that makes you laugh. That's the hardest thing to do.
It is very hard. It is.
Without it being like circus music.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think this has a little bit of that, which I'm real happy about.
Minnesota. Thank you. Cunliffe is our guest this evening on Improvised Thoughts, and we're listening to his new album, A Rare Connection, on the Discovery label. You received a National Endowment for the Arts grant in 1988, and in 1989 you won the Thelonious Monk Jazz Piano Award. Tell us a little bit about that, about those awards, and what difference they made to you in your career.
Well, the National Endowment thing was really kind of the first opportunity that I ever had to do a really first-class demo tape. So, I won some money to do that, so I went to New York and hired some really great musicians there. Lynn Seaton, an old friend of mine, a bass player from Cincinnati, who used to play with Count Basie. And one of my favorite drummers on the planet, Billy Hart. I had never recorded with him and really wanted to do something with him. So we did a little trio session, and I submitted that the next year to the Monk competition people to... I really didn't think... The main reason for contests for me is to kick a little, you know, just to kind of get you into the mode of working.
Right.
And I'm sometimes am lazy, and I need to do things to make me practice. And entering contests, I've entered a couple of contests over the years, and they make you practice. They say, well, you know, you're going to go up there in front of all those people, so, you know, and the Monk thing sounded perfect because I really love Monk's music, but some of it's kind of intimidating, and I really want to maybe have an excuse to plunge in there and really get into some of his music. So, sent in the tape and was informed that I was a semifinalist. So, they will put you up. You have to buy your own ticket if you want to fly to Washington and do this. And my parents live in Andover, Massachusetts, where I grew up. So I was, you know, this worked out great. I can go up there, do the contest, and then go see my mother and dad. But then I found out the news that my mother had lung cancer.
Aww.
It was very serious, and they were going to operate. So right after the competition was over, I had to go home and kind of hang out. So that's kind of where my mind was. My mind really wasn't on music very much.
Right.
I think that might have helped. I think that I was playing. I was kind of, well, who really cares? What is all this? This is all silly. I mean, what really is important is our families and our loved ones and how they are. I wasn't really concerned about winning a competition. I was just trying to play and say something and have fun.
Well, that probably took the edge of anxiety off to the point where it did make a difference, don't you think?
I think so. The fact that I wasn't really worried about it.
Right.
You know, all the other, a lot of the guys I talked to were like, well, you know, oh, this is important. And I just really didn't care. I really wasn't, you know. But she came through very well. You know, she's fine. And
that's great.
So, you know, it all's well and ends well.
And you came through very well, too.
Yes, I did.
By winning the award. What does that award do in terms of, other than the prestige that it brings you, is there a monetary award that you can use, or is there...
Yes, there is. That's a $10,000 prize.
That's terrific.
And $5,000 of it is given to you, and $5,000 of it you use to study with people.
Uh-huh.
And I actually studied for a year with a very great New York piano player and teacher named Hal Galper.
Oh, yeah.
And he's fantastic. We had a wonderful time hanging out and talking about music, and so it all worked out really great that way. I think that I've kind of wrestled with this in the years since the Monk competition got established. Guys, you know, won the award and immediately signed major label deals, and you know, nothing like that happened for me at all.
Yeah.
And I think there were a combination of factors that went into that. First of all, I think that the more we get into the 90s and the more we get further, in the 40s and 50s, jazz was pop music, you know.
Right.
The music that was on the radio was kind of jazz-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like that now. So I think that people don't know as much what's good anymore. They have to be told.
I agree.
The media kind of tells us what we're supposed to listen to and watch and all of that. And because of that, the music industry relies on image to sell their music as opposed to quality of music. I mean, they still rely on quality of music, but they also rely on image. And the image that they try to present now is of a young New York East Coast jazz player.
Right.
I wasn't really that young. I mean, I was 32, so I was one of the older winners. And I lived in L.A., which no one... People in New York just don't think much of L.A. They don't
That's
really
true.
Think of the jazz.
They don't. They do not.
The paradoxical thing is I'm from Boston. I just moved there a few months earlier. I think a lot of these things added up to kind of not... It really didn't help at all. It really didn't mean anything except for the money and just kind of the self-satisfaction of winning the award, which is actually fine. I'm totally happy with what happened.
It looks good on the resume, and it makes a nice thing in your press package. It when you see Thelonious Monk's name attached to anything, it gives it a little more credibility.
Well, the important thing about it is that it forced me to kind of deal with Monk and try to put what he does, try to establish that part of my personality. I think you need a bit of Monk in you to be a fine jazz piano player.
I agree.
I think there's a rhythmic and harmonic language there and a style and a time feel that really helps. So, I mean, that's the reason I entered the competition, and I'm really happy about that. And in fact, after a while, I played in a band with a guy named Buell Nilinger, who's a very fine bass player in L.A. And we had a band for a year, and we just played Monk's music all the time. And we worked clubs just playing Monk's music. And it was a really, really great musical experience for me. It really helped me get into Monk. But he's hard. Monk takes a lot of work.
It does. I've been playing Round Midnight for probably 30 years, and it's only in the past maybe 4 or 5 years that I felt like I even could remotely approach what was going on in that tune.
Yes.
And I'm just now starting to really deal with tunes like Ruby My Dear and Panonica and some of those very esoteric tunes.
Yeah, I think the best way to deal with Monk is to learn how he did the tunes pretty much as close to note for note as you can. And
I
once
agree.
You get to that point and you know what he did, then you can kind of get away from it a little and incorporate things that you like in there. But I think you really need to know not only the melody and the harmony, but some of the inner voices and things that he does. Because what he does is so makes the tune.
Crepuscule with Nelly comes to mind because it's hard not to do that exactly the way it's written down, because you'll lose something.
I know. That's why I don't play that tune. I mean, if I do play it, I just kind of play it the way Monk played it.
Well, me too. I play it with a saxophone player who's in my band, and that takes a little bit of the pressure off of trying to get all of that stuff together under your fingers to have the saxophone player doing one of the parts. But it's very hard. It's more like playing classical music to be faithful to all of those inner harmonies that
exactly.
he had.
Exactly. But if you do that, you really get a wealth of knowledge about Monk. And there are guys like Tommy Flanagan and Barry Harris who can play it just the way Monk played it, but then they have their own slant on.
Right, exactly.
Which I really like.
I do, too. My band does a lot of Monk tunes, the more traditional things like I Mean You and the things that are based on standard changes and rhythmic changes and stuff. And those are really fun to play, just the same way you'd play an Ellington tune.
Sure.
I want to go to a tune called Jamaican Lounge Lizards, and that came to mind in the middle of the stream here because there's a little section in there that I love, the little barroom brawl piano kind of thing that really is the kind of thing that it brings that musical smile to your face the way Monk's music does. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this tune and set it up for us, and we'll listen to Jamaican Lounge Lizards.
Well, I've always loved reggae tunes. In fact, my good friend John Clayton, the bass player, wrote a tune called Teef, which it was kind of a reggae thing, and he worked with Monty Alexander for 2 years, so that's where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
I've loved the fact that reggae has this beat that people just start moving their heads to, and yet you can play... you know, bebop over it.
Absolutely.
You know? So I like that about it. And Peter Erskine is a great reggae drummer. He's really into that Steely Dan type thing because he plays with Steely Dan as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it would be kind of fun to do that. And I wrote this reggae tune, and it just kind of got harmonically denser and denser and got thicker and thicker. And finally, the only way it seemed it could go would be to go into this stride piano barroom thing. So that's what happened. It just kind of went into that. I'm not really sure why.
When I was first listening to the album, and I put this record on, and all of a sudden, I was out of the room, and I came running back in the room, and I said, what in the world was that? And I went back and went to the front of the tune again to make sure I had the same tune on. And it was just, I got so tickled, I just sat down and laughed. It's just a wonderful piece.
Thank you.
Let's listen to Jamaican Lounge Lizards. We're talking to Bill Cunliffe, and we'll be back as soon as the record is over. Here's Jamaican Lounge Lizards.
Okay. Thank you.
Jamaican Lounge Lizards. I love that piece. We're speaking, again, to the audience, we're speaking to Bill Cunliffe. When you travel, when you're touring, do you take, a trio, or do you rely on people when you get there, or do you take the full complement of horns and everything? How does that work?
Well, when I can, I take a trio. Mm-hmm. But most of the time with the budgets that are going on, I'm a new artist just starting out, so I tend to go out as a soloist and pick up a bass player and a drummer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the standard right now because the money isn't very great.
Right.
But
right.
You got to get out there. You got to support your thing. And so that's what I'm doing.
All right. Well, it's just been wonderful to talk to you. And again, it's a wonderful recording. I've just had so much fun listening to this record. I've had it on for the past 2 days at my house and also in the car. It's my new favorite piano record.
Oh, that's great. And I'm really glad you like it.
I think you're going to be hearing a lot of people say that. My guest this evening has been Bill Cunliffe, wonderful pianist. His new Discovery label project is A Rare Connection. Bill, we're going to go out with a Jerome Kern tune, which I understand was the last tune he wrote before he died. Nobody else but me, and it's a fitting phrase to describe Bill Cunliffe. And I will say good night. This is B.G. Adair for Improvised Thoughts.